Committee on Education will come to order. It's Friday, March 13th. Welcome. If you have a cell phone, please turn it off so that you can thoroughly enjoy the testimony you're about to hear. We have three items on our agenda today. And first, I would like to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2786. Representative Greenlink.
Thank you. Can I bring a couple of wingmen with me?
Yes, please bring wingmen. I think that means you're committing yourself to sit in the middle.
I'm happy to sit in the middle. I get protection.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for offering me this opportunity to talk about House Bill 2786. I'm going to be careful not to say too much, because that requires more knowledge than I have. But one of the most exciting projects I ever worked with at OHSU.
Representative Greenlink, could you identify yourself for the record?
God, no. 3 times in a row.
What's the matter for you?
I'm sitting really good. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlink, House District 33, Northwest Portland, West to North Plains. And again, I'm very happy to be here with you today. When I was chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine, I met Dr. Martin here, and he told me about a very exciting project that was coming on, the project called Dangerous Decibels. And I was really happy to become a sort of advisor to the project and to work with Dr. Martin and staff dealing with some evaluation issues and some others. But this project was an extraordinarily interesting project, and you'll hear about it from my colleagues. It turned out to be both creating a demonstration, an exhibit at OMSI, and also creating and testing curricula in the schools, because we all believe in evidence-based work, even in education. And you'll hear about this story. I'm here to support them, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you have when they're done, if that serves your purpose. Telling us about Dangerous Decibels
and the whole program. Actually, Bob's going to go first.
And if you would follow Representative Greenlink's great example and begin your testimony by identifying yourselves to the record, I'd be grateful.
Did someone want our handout?
Of course.
Okay.
Handouts are wonderful. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one other request. Please don't speak at high frequencies because I can't hear them. Okay.
Are
As
you
a committee
being
chair,
sarcastic?
I try and make sure I speak that way so my vice chairs can't hear me.
It's Friday.
Okay.
Please welcome to our committee.
I'm Dr. Robert Fulmer, Associate Professor of Otolaryngology at Oregon Health and Science University. Thank you all for giving me the opportunity to speak in favor of House Bill 2786 today. The crux of this bill is based around noise-induced hearing loss. As its name implies, that's the kind of hearing loss one can acquire from exposure to sounds that are very loud, like music that's too loud, or power tools, gas lawnmower, leaf blower, chainsaws, things like that, or recreational hunting and shooting. So this can happen in leisure settings, or it can happen in occupational settings, it can happen during military service, and it has some dire consequences, this type of hearing loss. It's very common. At least 10 million Americans have noise-induced hearing loss, and that's a conservative estimate. It's probably closer to 20, 25 million. And at least 100,000 Oregonians have noise-induced hearing loss. Another conservative estimate is probably closer to a 250,000 people out there with noise-induced hearing loss in the state. The consequences of this type of hearing loss include communication difficulties, learning difficulties, lost productivity. There are high costs associated with rehabilitation, hearing aids, things like that. The only good thing about noise-induced hearing loss is that almost every case is preventable if people are aware of the hazards of loud noise and if they're taught to take just a few simple precautions to protect themselves. So basically, all people need to do is be aware of the sources of loud sounds, and if They need to be in that environment at work or during leisure activities, wear earmuffs or earplugs. If they're playing their music too loud or listening to music that's too loud on personal stereos, car stereos, they just need to turn it down. Or if they can, if they're at a nightclub or somewhere where there's a loud noise source or near some power tools, they don't have hearing protectors, they need to move themselves physically away from that sound source. So those are the simple messages that will prevent a lot of this expense and suffering that will reduce the prevalence of noise-induced hearing loss. And another nasty consequence of it can be constant ringing in the ears, tinnitus or tinnitus, which affects many more million people. And the base cause of many cases of tinnitus is excessive noise exposure. So in this bill, we're asking that teachers in Oregon in grades K through 12, when they're giving lessons, existing lessons on hearing or sound or music or health, and they're talking about the topics of hearing, that they just inject some of these messages about how students can protect themselves. Because if we wait and we start talking to people when they're adults, well, they've already developed some bad habits, and it's not part of their culture to take precautions. So, for instance, the Centers for Disease Control has recently added noise-induced hearing loss to its list of important health topics for children and adolescents, and they've developed information on a web page about noise-induced hearing loss. It's in the back of those little packets that went around. And that provides all the information that a teacher would need to provide this information to students. And there are many other resources on the web and elsewhere where this information is available. And as the CDC says on its website, establishing healthy behaviors during childhood is easier and more effective than trying to change unhealthy behaviors during adulthood. So among the things we'd like to see happen is to just raise public awareness about these issues, because if people aren't aware of the dangers of loud sounds, then they're more likely to develop noise-induced hearing loss from loud noise exposure, and also to provide some instruction starting in elementary grades. Another thing that's in this little packet that went around are recommendations dating back to 1974, and there might have been some before that. So for 35 years, experts in hearing and health education across the nation have recommended that hearing loss prevention education should be provided in schools, starting in elementary school. And if the message is repeated in these different classes, in science classes, or when teachers are talking about science, music, hearing, health, then the messages are more likely to stick, and students, as they grow, are more likely to implement these protective behaviors.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I had a question when you went through that. What is, I've always wondered, the correct pronunciation of that word? Is it tinnitus or
you said tinnitus? It's either one. Well, I grew up in San Francisco, worked down there. Most people said tinnitus. Moved to Portland, where there's the first tinnitus clinic in the world. So they said tinnitus.
It's like potato, potato. Tinnitus.
Yeah, pretty much. Caribbean. But it's nasty. Dr. Billy Martin and I worked together for 10 years in the OHSU tinnitus clinic. Very unhappy people, many of whom say they wish they had been told about the dangers of loud noise exposure and they could have protected themselves.
Thank you. Please.
Madam Chairman and Committee, thank you so much for allowing us time to come and offer support for this bill. And my name is William Martin. I live at 7450 Southwest 17th Drive in Portland, Oregon, 97219. I don't know if you need that. I've never done this type of thing before. I have a driver's license. I come to you as a professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, and also, because of Mitch, a professor of public health and preventive medicine. He drafted me out of my evil ways in clinical medicine and got me into prevention. I'm very grateful for that. I hope that I can serve
you as an expert witness or an expert testimony and information related to this bill that I think is very important, and I do support it. Noise-induced hearing loss is a significant health risk for our children. A national study showed that 12.5% of the children in the United States have hearing loss that can be exclusively attributed to noise exposure, not genetics, not infection, not trauma, but from noise itself. This is 6 to 19-year-olds. We did our own study of over 11,000 12 to 18-year-old Oregonian children and found that we found 13% of our Oregon children had hearing loss in the same frequency range as we would find with noise-induced hearing loss. That's about 4 children in every Oregon classroom just from noise exposure. We found that 31% of that group had fired a gun during the last year. Rural Oregon, there's a lot of kids out there. 10 years old is when you start. We found that 16%, in another study we did, of our children are listening to their personal stereo systems at levels that exceed all national safety levels every single day of the week. So our children are at risk. They're showing evidence of hearing loss. And so the problem is real. It's not something that's fabricated. The second thing is that hearing loss costs society money. There was an interesting survey of 40,000 American households that found that the price of hearing loss in lost revenues was up to $12,000 per individual per year. That's a $122 billion nationally. That resulted in an $18 billion loss in tax revenues that was unrealized just because of hearing loss, of untreated hearing loss. It's perfectly reasonable to expect that that proportion would also apply to the citizens of Oregon. The third thing is that noise-induced hearing loss can be prevented through education. Several studies, including our own research in Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington and Douglas counties with elementary school children, first, fourth, and seventh grade children, has shown that educational programs can be designed, educational information can be delivered that will change knowledge attitudes and the tough one, behaviors in kids, long-term behaviors in children, if it's done properly. And the thing I've been learning in public health is that you have to hit them early and often and use different types of modalities. That's why the school system is a perfect place to integrate this message. The fourth point, my final point, is that effective interventions are already available, and these are very inexpensive. And as Mitchell was pointing out to you, we have the great privilege of working on a program, a collaboration between several Oregon institutions, including the National Center for Rehabilitative Auditory Research, the American Tinnitus Association, Portland State University, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, and OHSU, working together with the public school systems to develop resources that were effective. We had funding from the Northwest Health Foundation, from the Ford Family Foundation, from the National Institutes of Health, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to do this over the last 10 years. The resources include a permanent museum exhibition at OMSI. That's amazing. If you ever go there, go up to the third floor. There's a giant ear that all of you will fit through, because I can fit through it. Mitch can fit through it. There are web-based complementary activities that are available that are now been translated into French, and we've had requests to translate them into Spanish, Swedish, German, and Malay. There's a classroom program, a preset classroom curricula that's available. We have, if needed, there are educator training workshops to train teachers. We've done training workshops in Colorado, Canada, Hawaii, here in Portland, and soon to be New Zealand. New Zealand has decided as a country to put this particular program in every single school in the entire country. We have resources that have been used in 37 U.S. states and 11 different countries now. The vast majority of these things are online, downloadable for free. They have already been proven and demonstrated to be effective. The materials are Oregon grown, Oregon tested, Oregon proven, and something that should not present a large obstacle for schools that want to have something that's prepackaged that they can get very inexpensively and very easily. The information can be integrated into math and science classes as well as health and performing arts programs, so it can fit anywhere. So, in summary, my points are: Oregon children need to learn how to protect themselves. They're out making a lot of noise, and they have no idea what the dangers are and how to protect themselves. That educational interventions absolutely will work. That the resources are available at minimal cost and hassle, I guess, to teachers and schools that are already overworked and already completely burdened beyond their imagination. So this information should enhance and complement their existing academic programs. And the potential to benefit all Oregonians is great. And thank you very much. If there are any questions, I would be more than willing to answer them.
If I could just add one thing, if I may. The solutions really aren't all that complicated, and I was reminded of Billy earlier in the week when I went to a Trailblazer game. And Harry and I got in the habit of taking earplugs with us at Trailblazer games, especially during the playoffs when the level rises very high. But there's a part in the game before they introduce the Portland players where the music gets extraordinarily loud. And what I've just taken to do is put my hand over my ears, put my fingers in my ear, and protect myself at that moment from that. I mean, I can feel the music in my chest, so I know it's too high. But, I mean, what I learned from Billy is that simple thing makes a difference in that time. And these are the kind of lessons. This isn't all that complex to help kids recognize when there's a problem and they have simple solutions to dealing with it.
The good part is if you cheer loud enough and they score 100 points, you get a free chalupa.
But you can't hear the crisp.
Well, we have no free chalupas here today, though we did have a good discussion about cookie dough.
Yeah.
Representative, I think there's questions for the panel. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Martin, a question for you in your testimony here on the number two, hearing loss costs Oregon money, and it says here individuals with hearing loss earn up to $12,000 less, which I find fascinating. What degree of hearing loss? Are we talking about my father-in-law we just yell at, or are we talking about profoundly deaf, or what?
The degree of lack of revenue is directly in proportion to the amount of hearing loss. So the more hearing loss you have, the more you lose. And I'd be happy to send you that article. It's if you would like, I can do that.
Okay.
Because it has the graphs. It graphs it out based on the amount of hearing loss you have and the amount of revenue lost.
It's proven by the fact that as my hearing got less, I decided to become a legislator.
You stole my joke.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First question is for Representative Springer. Just kind of curious if her father-in-law is hard of hearing or if she just yells at him for other reasons.
I'm not testifying. I can't answer that
question. Clarification on that or not. And I did want to point out, although I'm supportive and I like your information, we do understand that this is still not going to stop Oregon kids from saying, huh, to their mom and pretending they didn't hear when asked to take out the trash and do the dishes. They pretend they didn't hear. This will not have any effect or change on that.
Are you
noted
doing the
in
same
my family
thing,
that's
right?
Not limited
I speak
to
from
children.
Experience.
Hey, are you doing the same thing?
and wives all across Oregon ask Mitch to bring this thing. My husband just doesn't hear me.
Bingo. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a zillion questions. No, actually about four. First, you talked about there being information that is downloadable from the Internet. Do you have a website you could share with us that we could look at?
It's on the sheet that I gave you, the very last item.
Okay, there's too much information here. Okay, thank you.
The last two pages of the CDC web pages that were just developed that have guidelines and strategies for educators, parents, students.
I see it now. And then follow up, if I may. How extensive would it... Okay, so if a school did not avail themselves of this information that is already prepared and just use something different, how extensive would the instruction need to be in these classes in order to satisfy the requirement of this bill? Does that make any sense?
Is that to
well?
Me
I mean, just is there?
Let's talk about how extensive.
Did like 15 minutes of turning up the music is bad and it's cumulative, and you need to use earplugs when you're going to rock concerts. Is that would that be considered information satisfying this bill?
And the critical point is efficacy. the program that we've developed is very well defined. Currently, it is a 45-minute classroom program. What we find is when teachers come and take the training, they rearrange it into their schedule according to their But the key components, which are listed in the bill, those key bits of information can be used in very many creative ways to bring that across. I don't know if just that information came, if it would change behaviors, and our emphasis has been on developing resources that actually change behaviors. Knowledge is easy to change in children. In fact, we all learn things that our parents didn't want us to learn. And today, children will learn things very readily, but changing behaviors is tough. And so the emphasis has been on that. The bill requirements make suggestions as to the topics, but it does not require, it leaves the complete freedom up to the teachers to make that determination, which I think should be protected.
I would say something is better than nothing.
Okay.
Because if they never hear anything, then they don't even have a choice. They're not even aware of the...
And they'll never hear anything.
The dangers. Yeah, that too. Okay.
One last question. And
one last question.
What you're talking about is leaving it up to the teachers to present. I hear from local school districts all the time, we're saying, we're so tired of state mandates.
Yes.
Okay. So that leads me to why not make the case to have this information presented to each school district?
And
I can answer that one, if you may. It's Mitch Greenlick again. What you actually have here is an aspirational bill. And it leaves it up to, it doesn't have teeth and it doesn't have anything specific, but the hope would in this case that the Department of Education would start saying, you guys ought to do this kind of thing, and if you want help, we can give you curricula that can be added. I mean, we're talking about things that are added 3 or 4 times in a semester. I mean, it's not a huge amount. And it's to highlight that the issue is an issue. There could be more teeth. This could be a formal instruction to the Department of Education. This could turn into a mandate. But this was an attempt to be more than a memorial, but to put in statute this aspiration, so that when people are creating curricula, they say, oh, here's something we ought to be thinking when we're talking about science. Here's something you ought to be thinking when we're teaching somebody to play the tuba. It really doesn't have a formal mandate, but it has a sort of aspiration for what ought to happen.
Okay, thank you. So it's like a heavy memorial, statutory light.
That's exactly.
Got it.
Statutory light.
Thank you, Representative Parker.
My point is, Chairman Gelser.
Yes.
Can I add one more comment?
Of course.
One of the things that we find is when we go into places that it's not even on anybody's radar screen, that everyone knows that if a bomb goes off, your ears will ring and you may get some hearing loss. But across society, people do not have an appreciation at all for what levels and what durations of sounds will actually cause damage. So they don't even know what to avoid. And the school system is the best venue for communicating that information because they're already getting physics of sound and biology and health information already. So I believe it's great to aspire to have it in that venue without increasing the burden. And part of the reason why we want to offer these resources that we had no idea this bill was going to be introduced when we were developing these things. It's a wonderful coincidence that all this stuff is ready to go. It's the most convenient opportunity that we could have. So,
and also, I misspoke. It's not when you teach somebody to play the tuba that it's an issue, because they sit at the back of the orchestra. It's when you teach somebody to play the violin that's an issue. And this has become, in fact, an occupational injury problem with the musicians' union, because a violinist for a symphony can't afford to have his or her hearing dulled, but they're also afraid to come in and talk about it because they could lose their chair. So if you go to symphony now, you'll see plastic shields at various places dealing with reducing the sound pressure on the violinists, especially on the people in the front of the orchestra.
Thank you. Representative Pomp.
We're kind of alluding to the question that I had with some of the previous comments, but I've absolutely had the pleasure and honor of sitting in hundreds and hundreds of classrooms and observing lessons and lessons being taught, particularly in band, health, science. And I have observed lessons being taught on this subject repeatedly. And so my question is it not already in the health and music performing arts curriculum? And I don't know what standards are already developed around that, but if we need to have some additional updates on that, I think that's great with it. The science that's now evolving is really critical. But and maybe I'm fortunate with the teachers that I've had the pleasure to observe, but this is a regular lesson in a lot of classrooms. And so I don't know if you've checked with what is the current standards.
Chairman Gelser?
Yes, please.
Respond?
That tends to be, I mean, I'm really excited to hear that, but when we talk to schools and teachers, when we were doing our research and going into communities all over Oregon, we found that to be by far the exception rather than the rule.
Okay, thank you.
Most programs that we talked to, they thought it would, they welcomed it. They said, oh, this sounds really good, and the teachers had an appreciation because they know the kids are getting blasted. I mean, they hear the iPods. They can hear them down the hallway. So they have an emotional appreciation of it without the scientific credentialing.
Yeah, I think that might be the missing point.
Yeah.
But we might find that it is already in the curriculum.
Thank you. Representative Dimbrough.
It's been covered. Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess maybe I'll be a little disagreeable here, but as I look at this bill... It says this shall be included, and so that looks like a mandate to me. And it goes on to say the instruction may include information and talks about the specifics, but I clearly see this as a mandate. I see it as a good idea, for sure, but I definitely see it as a mandate. So maybe you could talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, if you've seen other bills, for example, the one on personal finance, where we talked about the one on civics education, those bills were very specific in instructing DOE to do something about it, and we're trying to work the way through, because in those bills, we wanted the Department of Education to provide standards for the schools to do a variety of things. This, if this gets into statute in this form, and we could amend it to make it stronger, but I think that wasn't the intention here. I think it will provide a guideline for the curriculum development process as the curriculum is developed. So somebody's back there and says, oh, we're working on the fourth grade science curriculum. What are we talking about hearing in this curriculum? And it would simply provide, it would shine a bright light on the problem. And that's basically, in this form, all it's intended to do, rather than to say, DOE, go out, examine all the curricula, see if this is in it, do X, Y, or Z. I mean, for one thing, that is an unfunded mandate, or it gets a fiscal that makes it unreal in this day and age.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have found that when there is linkage between different agencies requiring similar things, this stuff works better in schools. Example, kids hated fire alarms, and they hated all these other safety things that we teach them at the beginning of the year. But when they start hearing from business that that's what they spend most of their money on, training their people about safety issues, and business people came in and talked about one thing that we have to do in our business is to teach all these safety things. And we've started, I mean, Boley and others are starting to actually implement standards around machinery and other things and protective ear wear. And I guess I would hope that as we do this process, that we give those tools to people in schools so that they know what is the standard out there in industry if a person is working to protect them, because I know those are getting better. Because it makes it much easier when you're talking to young people, especially in the middle and high school, that you're going to get this training again, and they wouldn't be doing it if they didn't think that it was a problem, and therefore we're doing the same thing here. I mean, schools are getting a little bit better at teaching why we do some of these things, and that industry is doing it too. Because, you know, it used to be that we all had to be the toughest people, and therefore if you put headgear on when I worked at the mill, you know, yeah, you know, what a wimp, you know. Now, the guy that already had the ringing in his ear, he was already putting it on. But it was too late. He was already, but it hurt too much. He had to have it now. You know, we're starting to change that ethos in this country, that it would be much better to not have to wait until you were in pain before you stop the suffering. And I guess I think that this is part of that same overall movement to help us have longer, healthier lives.
Mm-hmm.
But we have an awfully big hurdle to get over. I come from the family, the rural family that, you know, shooting the guns and all that kind of stuff, you certainly weren't going to put air protectors on when you shot a gun. Now you got to buy them when you go out. I mean, it's really funny how things have changed. And I think we're getting there with hearing. Had a father that lost hearing because of illness. He had Meniere's, and so he had this ringing his whole life. And he said, you know, it's really horrible to go from being a fairly open, gregarious person to being a little bit paranoid all the time, because you always thought, especially on the side I can't hear from, are they talking about me? I mean, he said it's a strange change. I mean, he was not that way, but the hearing loss changed how he perceived the rest of the world in ways that he would never have expected. And so for all of us to try to figure out, just to mention something when you're at a concert, and I had to go to a lot of music things as a high school principal. And we talked about turning it down all the time. We tried to keep it down as mm-hmm. much as we could. And then they start saying they can't hear it. And I said, that's because you've been listening to it too long at the other point. And it's only when you haven't lost your hearing that you can actually hear that there's subtleties in that music, not just the whole body feeling. So I hope that we are connecting not only the curriculum that you have, but also to what their expectations are going to be when they get out in the workforce. Because those employers are getting very serious about this stuff now. Any comments?
Well, I was thinking that as you were talking, Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, that it's going to be very important if the shooting clubs and the ranges begin
they
to
start
do this.
Doing it.
And I was thinking of when you see on TV programs the police going... a scene where they're at their shooting range, they always have ear protection on. I thought, that's the kind of stuff, a policeman coming in and talking about, when I go to the range all the time and I'm shooting, I always wear ear protection. I mean, I think those ties are really very important ties.
Yeah. Madam Chairman?
Yes.
Can I share a short story that pertains to this, or are we running out of time?
A short story. We still have another panel and two more bills.
Okay. Is that okay?
Yes, please.
Okay, no,
please.
Just to address your issue, I have two daughters. The younger one, both of them were involved in the development of these resources because they were likely victims. They were at home, and they could be used as experiments for all these. My youngest daughter got a job in catering and went to her catering job, and it was a wedding. And it was a fun, crazy, wild, loud Mexican wedding. It was the loudest thing she'd ever been to. And everybody was having a great time. And the band was so loud, it was physically hurting her ears. She went to her supervisor, who was another high school student, and said, can I wear my earplugs? It's too noisy. Okay? And her supervisor said, well, of course not. You can't wear earplugs. You won't be able to hear the guests. So my daughter broke the law and snuck the earplugs in. And this is our goal, that our children will grow up, recognize the dangers in their workplace, and appropriate whatever they need to protect their hearing regardless of the consequences in their job. She didn't get fired, but that's the model that our goal is in this. And if we do this with the children when they're young, they won't need to be taught this when they get in the workplace. They will already have those behaviors in place.
Yeah, I agree.
Thank you. Representative Van Arman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sitting here kind of struggling, too. I do appreciate what you've brought forward, and I would like to add commuting in a Honda Civic to that list that you have. But I am trying to reconcile how we fit this in, and because I hear the mandate issue from the school districts as well. And I don't know if you have the answer, and I'm afraid, Representative Greenlick, that I'm not sure that your answer answered my question, which was similar to Representative Springer's.
Madam Chair, Representative Orman, let me make a different point. When we were talking about adding personal finance and civics education, which I think is going to go in some form pretty soon, we were talking about adding something new to the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about this, we're talking about putting substance into the curriculum for things that are already being taught.
Okay.
So, I mean, so when somebody starts talking about how the physics of hearing works, you start talking about how different levels of sound, different decibels, have different effects on the ear. This isn't, you should teach something new. These are pieces to put into the curriculum when you're teaching specific things at specific points. So, I mean, it's an aid to the teachers rather than something that they have to do in addition to the way they do it now.
Okay. Follow up. So the statement that says any curricula shall include. So I guess that supports what you're saying. When it says any curricula.
Yeah, it's just a part. I mean, it's just it provides substance for various components of a curriculum that they're already teaching.
All right. Now I get it. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any
And the teachers loved it. That was the other thing. When we gave it to them, they were delighted to have it.
Are there any further questions for this panel? Thank you both for coming and sharing your afternoon with us. Representative Greenlick, thank you for bringing
you,
us
Madam
this
Chair.
Bill and putting together a panel on such short notice as well. Our next group is Genoa Ingram and Morgan Allen, please.
Morgan has the deer in the headlight look.
We don't like to hear bills without bringing you here. After you made the comment about the warm-up act, we wanted to make sure you were part of every episode.
Backup? Not the warm-up.
Oh, I thought he was... Oh, okay. Please, Genoa. Great.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I am Genoa Ingram speaking on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Audiology, whose members on a daily basis see the results of the noise-induced hearing loss. The Oregon Academy of Audiology wholeheartedly supports this bill. They apologize that they can't have representatives here today. There was also a licensure board meeting today, and they are attending that and asked me to come here and be their voice on this bill. I passed out copies of testimony, however, from Wendy Chapman, who is the former president of the Oregon Academy of Audiology, and she likened this type of education to the smoking education that was implemented several years back, educating kids about the harms of smoking. And that has been, as you know, a very successful endeavor. And the members of the Oregon Academy of Audiology are hoping that this bill will have the same results that effort had. One of the most fascinating things that I've learned since working for the Oregon Academy of Audiology is that your ears never go to sleep. When we go to sleep at night, we close our eyes, we rest our eyes, we hopefully rest our minds, and we sleep. But one of the audiologists told me, they said, you know, if you have just a fan running, a furnace, just the hum of your home, your ears pick that up all night long, whether you're conscious of it or not. And that educated me, and now when I go to sleep at night, I try to make sure that the fans aren't running and things are turned down so that at least I give my ears a rest. I'll just close by saying that my husband was a farmer. He came from a long line of farming efforts, and he was driving combines, tractors, and other farm equipment from his preteens. And he claims that is why he can't hear me, although I have noticed that if I'm upstairs in the walk-in closet and he's down in the kitchen, he'll start talking and expect me to hear him. So but it is a very real... I can't imagine that had he known or had his parents known the damage that would cause, that they would have had their preteen child on those noisy farm implements without some protection. We would just like to close by thanking Representative Greenlick for bringing this bill forward, and we wholeheartedly support it and urge its passage.
Thank you very much. And because Morgan, for full disclosure, did not come to offer testimony, but he graciously agreed to come and answer questions. So does anyone have questions for Morgan and Genoa? Representative Springer.
What a coincidence.
What a coincidence.
Please forgive me, Morgan. I would be to blame for the deer in the headlights. Look, I just wanted to touch bases with you as far as the department. I love this idea. I'm all over it. I'm kind of stuck on the shall. So basically a two-part question. Will there be a rulemaking process that follows this? So what is this going to end up looking like in the end? And I'm not asking you, obviously, to project what those rules will be, but I'm assuming there will be a process. If you could outline that for us. And then, because I am concerned about how much of a mandate this feels like on schools, because I do see it as that. And then, can you give us a broader, very broad, brief overview of how this issue is addressed currently as far as standards?
Chair Gelser and Representative Springer, to be perfectly honest, I'm not familiar with what is currently in the health standards related to hearing, but I certainly can get
Morgan,
that. Oh, I'm sorry.
Would you identify yourself?
Sorry. Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. And Representative Springer, to be perfectly honest, I would need to go back and talk to our folks. But generally, what happens is we have some people have heard me say this. The department is in the business of creating standards. We take what the legislature says our children must learn before they graduate, and we create standards at grade levels, you know, levels of math, levels of reading, these types of things. It's left to the districts have wide discretion. The districts are basically in the curriculum business. So we give guidance. We review textbooks and curriculums and say to districts, you know, these textbooks or these curriculum that you can buy off the shelf or from textbook companies meet the standards that we have set for student learning. But as long as whatever you come up with includes this. So districts would have quite a bit of flexibility because even though they have to have some instruction on this in their curriculum, it's a may on the other end of it. So they'd have some wide latitude to determine what to do that, what that would include. But I could get some more information and bring it back to the committee. But I do read it as something that they would have to ensure that in all of their K through 12 classes that they would need to include some type of instruction. And that's really, as I said, they're given a lot of latitude. But I would need to check the standards and see where it's already included in the health standards right now and to answer your question fully.
And thank you. And sincerely, I do apologize because I didn't expect you to have every piece of information, although that you usually have quite a bit of information for us. I appreciate that. So please forgive me on that level. And again, I just go back to as long as this is just not an overwhelming piece for schools, because I stand on that floor a lot and talk about mandates and telling schools what to do and telling them how to behave.
Representative Springer, I'll be happy to get the information. And my suspicion is since none of my colleagues and friends from COSA and OSBA are here to testify against the bill that it's probably not super burdensome. They generally are here to talk about mandates. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Morgan.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. And I just hit a button and lost my questions, but I think I remember basically what it was. Do we need the law? Would you be able to put something like that in to the standard without us? And if not, would a resolution have any benefit?
Chair Gelser and Representative Thatcher, I believe in order to get it into the standard, we would probably need some sort of direction from the legislature or the State Board of Education. So I don't think I would need to check with our folks, but I don't think we could just choose to add things to the standard without some sort of statutory or administrative rule direction from either the legislature or the State Board.
Are there any further questions for? Nope. Sure. All right. Thank you both very much. And thank you to Representative Greenlick and to our doctors and others for bringing this bill. It's very interesting, and we will continue the discussion. And with that, I'm going to carefully not bang my gavel too loud. I am closing the public hearing on House Bill 2786 and opening a public hearing on House Bill 2111. Morgan Allen, please. Rick, do you want to give a brief overview of what this is?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. This abolishes and repeals the Public Charter School Development Fund, and it requires any money left in there as of the biennium to be transferred to the Department of Education account established under statute and will be effective 2009. Thank you, Chair. And this does have a ways and means supplement referral.
Morgan, would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education here to talk to you about House Bill 2111, which, despite its intimidating bill summary and its shortness, it's really just a technical cleanup bill to remove a provision of statute that is no longer needed and is obsolete because federal law around charter school grant funding has changed. And one of the things I'd like to talk about, too, if this committee sees fit to move this bill forward, I don't believe it would need to go to Ways and Means because it doesn't actually involve the transfer of any money or anything like that. So we could talk about that. But what the bill does, it abolishes what's called the Public Charter School Development Fund that was created in Oregon Revised Statute 338175. That fund was originally created to process loans that were given to charter schools that were funded by federal grants, but over the last few years, federal law has changed, and these types of loans are no longer made to charter schools. In fact, according to our folks, there have only been a handful of these loans ever made in Oregon, maybe three or so, and all of those have been paid back. So the fund is really no longer relevant, and actually, in 2006, the department did an internal audit of state school fund, and one of the recommendations of that audit was to get some clarification around the statute. So after consulting with the Attorney General and Treasurer's Office, we all came to the conclusion that this statute is no longer needed. And I know, Representative Huffman, I've spoken to one of your superintendents a few times, and hopefully I'm addressing some of the questions that you might have directly. But essentially, the bill, just I want to make it very clear, the bill does not impact charter school funding in Oregon, either state school fund, school improvement fund, or the federal charter grants. It has no impact on funding. And some questions have arisen about the department's authority to apply for and receive federal funds and enter into contracts and agreements with the federal government. In short, I've talked to our legal department and our financial department, and we have all the statutory authority we need to go out and seek federal funds and collect those funds and distribute those types of grants. And I can talk a little bit more about that if any of you would like. So the takeaway message I want folks to understand is that this bill will not impact any processes we use to disseminate federal grants. There is no effect on federal charter school grants. There's no effect on funding to charter schools. It really is just removing a piece of statute that's no longer applicable to federal law.
Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Morgan, my question was along the lines to make sure that if a charter school closes its doors, that no district monies that, you know, should be left in the district weren't swept out into the department.
Yeah, Chair Gelser and Representative Huffman, I can double-check with our folks, but that concern hasn't been arisen in any discussions with our folks, and I do not believe that would happen.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like this was a dedicated fund, as you said, for charter school loans so they could get started. So it sounds like there's no money left in the fund.
Chair Gelser and Representative Van Orman, that is correct. There's currently not any money in the fund. And what happens right now, essentially there's three different types of federal grants that charter folks can apply for. There's a planning phase grant that you can get a maximum of $55,000. So if you're thinking about starting up a charter school, you can get some federal money even before you have an approved charter agreement with the school district. You can apply for up to $225,000 for an implementation phase grant, so as you're getting started and getting your school up and running. And there's a continuation grant that you can actually apply for as well from the federal government. Once you're up and running, you can get some additional monies, and I believe the maximum for that's $225,000. So theoretically, a charter school could get up to about $500,000, $505,000 in federal grant money. As a matter of fact, we're in the process right now of receiving grants. Today at 5 p.m. Is the closing date for applications for those. I want to say we have between about 25 and 30 grants that our folks are going to be reviewing. We have a review panel that reviews those, and then they decide how to award the grants. So that process is actually happening right now as we speak.
So follow up. Yeah, and this is a question so that I understand the system of the state. So when you abolish this fund, does it require that it goes to some, like, ways and means or revenue so that there's a process it goes through so that they can abolish it?
Chair Gelser and Representative Van Orman, I do not believe that is needed.
Okay.
All right. Representative Thatcher.
I'm having technical difficulties over here, but anyhow, I just know that Obama has stated that he's big on charter schools and he might send money to states. So if Oregon got a chunk of that federal money, would it just sit in the account, ODE account, be commingled with all the other funds, or would there be a separate account set up?
Chair Gelser and Representative Thatcher, my understanding is that, and it's actually referenced in the bill on page 1, line 7, ORS 326115, and I believe that statute is and I'm not a finance expert, but I believe that statute is where other funds and federal funds that we receive go.
Okay, thank you for clarifying.
Thank you. Are there further questions on this bill? No, colleagues, we have the fiscal impact statement and the revenue impact statement. What we do not have because I didn't ask for one, is a letter from the Speaker rescinding the referral to Ways and Means. And I think for the benefit of this bill, I would prefer we not work it today so we can rescind the referral, and it will probably make it to the floor faster if we don't vote on it today. Yeah, so let's carry this bill over to Monday, March 16th.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I appreciate you getting that for us.
Thank you. And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2111. Do I have to open the work session to carry over the work session?
No.
No? Great. Thank you. And the next bill is my bill, and there's nobody to testify on it. So, Representative Springer, would you do this?
How loud can I do this?
Well, I'm walking away, and my ears are already
scarred. As loud as you want.
As loud as you want. You're the chair.
We just have to plug our ears.
So did you open this public hearing?
I did not.
Okay. I'll open a public hearing on HCR number 4. And I'd remind everybody to please turn off your cell phones. They're awfully loud.
Very loud. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis, House District 16. And House Concurrent Resolution 4 would congratulate the Heart of the Valley Children's Choir, which serves children from Corvallis, Philomath, Albany, and Salem. It started 25 years ago. It's the 25th anniversary commemoration as a small choir, but it now serves over 300 children. And for the purpose of honesty, one of those children is my own, and yet another one of my children, because I have so many previously sang with this choir. But it's a great choir. It's a great youth program. The kids learn responsibility and service in addition to building their musical skills. And as they grow older through this choir, they have many travel opportunities, and these kids have traveled by invitation to Europe, to China. They have sung in some of the best singing places in the world, and they have also been ambassadors to our sister city in Uzhgorod. So I would urge your support of this. The choir is coming, their older children in the choir are coming to sing for us on April 9th, and so I'm hoping that if we pass this out to the floor, we can set it as a special order of business so that as they open our session for us, we can then have them watch our process and they can see this congratulation happen for them.
Any questions? Senator Brooklyn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we've had a lot of testimony today about noise, and now you're going to commemorate a 300-piece vocal group. Do you know if they are given ear protection before they sing and other things, especially those in the front that have to have all the pressure of the music behind them?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I cannot recall any conversations with my children about that, though they do know not to drink milk or eat dairy products on the day of a concert.
Okay. May I answer that question?
I hope that you will talk to them about making sure that they understand about ear and hearing loss.
I will, and Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I think that for all of you that have children, grandchildren, you recognize the frequency of opportunity iPods offer to us to have that conversation with kids.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you. I would like to respond to Representative Roland. Roland, excuse me. A singer needs to be able to hear so that they stay on key.
I know.
And you don't even wear earrings because it will deflect the sound. So that's a very important thing. But I also want to end by saying that one of the most important things that came to me is very true. Somebody said, a couple of years ago, she was in orchestra, and she had an opportunity to play hooky. And she thought about it, and she said, I can't go. My orchestra needs me. And that, I think, is one of the beauties of group music, because everybody feels that they're a part of it, and they have to be on key, or they have to be there.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had to respond since I have a daughter whose statement in high school was, why would I not take choir? A day without music is not a day worth living. So we've had a lot of conversations about hearing. and she was in music deals. But I do, it is important that, that people really do this, because when the choirs get larger and there are some very high voices at times that can be very shrill, and little choirs have a tendency to do some stuff that screaming in people's ears and doing those things. Because I agree with you, having good hearing is essential for those music kids. And I think I've actually heard of this group before because mm-hmm. of some of the stuff that they've done. So I think it's a really great thing to do, and I appreciate you bringing it, because these kids put in a lot of time and effort, and many of us do not know how many hours both the students put in and the parents do getting them to and from these places. And any kind of recognition for them is truly something we should do. So thank you for bringing it.
And Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman mentioned that need of belonging and that need to be there. I think that's a neat thing about this or any organized activity that kids do. For some kids, it's sports. Mm-hmm. For some kids, it's choir or orchestra or band. For some children, it's their theater program. But anything that we can do to encourage kids to be part of something that isn't just them, where they're learning that they have an obligation to other people to do their part, to be prepared, to show up, these are just critical skills that we're imparting to kids, and these are the things where it's engaging those kids in something that lights them on fire. This is the way that it happens, and it only happens because of the dedicated staff and volunteers that wrap around the kids to make that work, and they're the unsung heroes of organized activity for kids.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
That's fine. I just comment. It's my whole life's problems because I didn't take out my earring.
Yeah. always off key. Were you Representative Farmer?
Yeah. Way off key.
I was looking for a key. Give me a key.
Do I chair again now? Am I allowed to chair? Okay. Thank you.
If you like.
Representative Dimbrough. So I closed the public hearing on HCR4, open...
That's pretty loud.
Oh, no, I closed the public hearing on HCR4, and I open a work session on HCR4, and it's Friday. Representative Dimbrough, do you have a motion?
I have a motion, Madam Chair. I move HCR4 to the floor with a be-adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Dimbrough moves HCR4 to the floor with a be-adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion is adopted, and HCR4 is... Oh, was there an objection?
I was thinking.
He's just goofing around.
Seeing none, the motion passes, and HCR4 is adopted and headed to the floor. That completes our agenda for the day. The carrier. I will carry this bill. Gelser will carry the bill. So next week we'll come back. Representative Comp.
Before we conclude, I just have to make a comment. As the mother of four daughters, if we could do something about the decibel when girls scream at games, that would be really nice. I always told my daughters, you can play so long as you don't scream. If you scream, you're done. I'm serious.
He's suggesting an amendment.
No, but it is a real concern.
Thank you, Representative Comp. And if you'd like, you can join me tomorrow morning at my daughter's Civil War basketball game where lots of elementary school girls will compete against one another. So we're adjourning for this week. Next week we're coming back. I wanted to alert you to a couple of things on the agenda. Monday we have a bill that relates to driver's licenses and the Department of Transportation, which will be a fun detour for our committee. And we're having an informational hearing on diploma standards. Wednesday we have an informational hearing on early childhood. Also, just wanted to give you the heads up, the agenda has been posted. Wednesday, we do have a School for the Blind agenda item to begin discussions of the potential closure of the Oregon School for the Blind. So you may start hearing about that in your email boxes. And have a wonderful weekend, and we're adjourned.